We're going to look at six separate Bible stories. You know them well. You're quite familiar with them. But at the end, we're going to review them and see if we can find what the common factor in them is unique. Why do you find certain things evident in each one of them? Let's begin by turning to Genesis 45, verse 1. And I'm going to give you the background of the story, and you're well familiar with it. It's the story of Joseph. And I'm not going to go through the entire story because you are, as I said, very familiar with it. But toward the end of the time when his brother were traveling back and forth to get food and finding their money returned to them and going through that scenario and then having to leave one of their brothers there and not return unless their younger brother came back. And so this is the story beginning in Genesis 45, verse 1. Then Joseph couldn't refrain himself before all them that stood by him. And he cried, "Cause every man to go out from me." Now, if you think about this, Joseph was second in command, only next to Pharaoh in the country of Egypt. If this was the President of the United States, he'd have a whole group of Secret Service men surrounded him. And I'm sure that Joseph was the same way. He probably had advisors, he had bodyguards. But he said, "I want everyone to leave." And of course, they would be concerned because they'd be concerned for his safety, not knowing what was going on here. There were 11 men in that room alone with Joseph. And they might have been concerned for his welfare and his safety. But anyway, they obeyed, and there stood no man within while Joseph made himself known unto his brethren. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians and the house of Pharaoh heard. And maybe some of the bodyguards and those outside that had been told to leave were concerned that something was happening to him. Maybe, you know, he was being harmed by those 11 men because they heard this crying. And verse 3, "And Joseph said unto his brethren, I am Joseph." He makes that revelation. "Is my father still alive? Doth my father yet live?" And his brethren couldn't answer him. Now, it was a very simple question. You certainly would know if your father was alive or not. But they couldn't say anything because they were troubled at his presence. And, you know, well, might they be. If you think back to the story, if your brothers threw you in a big pit and there were inferences that you might be killed, but they decided to make a little money and they sold you to the Egyptians, and then you served Potiphar for however long he was with him, and then his wife, Potiphar's wife, wrongly accused him, so he ended back up in prison, and there he met the butler and the baker. And you know that story, how he said to the butler, who resumed his rightful position with Pharaoh, he said, "Remember me." But the butler forgot. And then later on, Pharaoh had the dream, and you know the story from there. But anyway, they were troubled because of what they had done initially. And also, The other part of that was that they had led their father to believe Joseph was dead because they took Joseph's coat of many colors, smeared it with the kid of a goat, and back there they didn't have DNA testing. So to Israel, when he looked at that coat, he thought it had to be Joseph because that was his coat. So those were the types of thoughts going through their minds when he said, I'm your brother. You know, they're thinking, what's he going to do? Now we're really in for it. Verse 4, and Joseph said unto his brethren, come near to me, I pray you. And they came near, and he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. So he was verifying to them that he in fact was Joseph. Verse 5, now therefore be not grieved nor angry with yourselves that you sold me hither, for God did send me before you to preserve life. That was the sole purpose of all of the things that Joseph had to go through to reach this point in the story. And why? He said, God did send me before you to preserve life. And it was only someone in his position that could preserve life at that point. And sometimes you might think, well, God has a certain sense of humor when he allows people to go through different things like this, but Joseph needed that kind of training, and there was a purpose for it down at the end, down to this point in time. Let's look at another example. Judges 13, verse 5. There's a man named Manoah, and an angel spoke to his wife. She was barren, and said, for lo, thou shalt conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come on his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite unto God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. And that was exactly what Samson did. If you know the story of Samson, you know the different things he did to thwart the Philistines. But then he ran into a problem. And, of course, you know what happened with Samson and Delilah. Well-known story, how he lost his strength when she cut his hair. And so the Philistines put his eyes out, and he was grinding wheat with this big millstone. And so one day they decided to have a celebration because they'd conquered this hero of Israel, and he was helpless. He couldn't do anything. So he asked a little boy that held him by his hand, who had led him out to the, you know, this center part of the Colosseum. And Judges 16, verse 28 is where this part of the story continues. Judges 16, verse 28. And Samson called unto the Eternal and said, O Lord God, remember me, I pray thee, and strengthen me, I pray thee, only this once, O God, that I may be at once avenged of the Philistines for my eyes. So it's payback time, if you allow me. Give me the strength. Verse 29, and Samson took hold of the two middle pillars upon which the house stood, and on which it was borne up, of the one with his right hand and the other with his left. So he grabbed him like this in verse 30. And Samson said, "Let me die with the Philistines." And he bowed himself with all his might, and the house fell upon the lords and all the people that were therein. So the dead which he slew at his death were more than they which he slew in his life, and the number of those people was 3,000 men and women. Now, if you want to compare and contrast this to something, think about the cabinet of the United States. There are 100 senators, 435 representatives. If you double those numbers for their wives or the spouses, and throw in the president, the vice president, the chiefs of staff, maybe even the governors, and multiplied that out, there'd be some number roughly between 1,300 and 1,500 people that essentially are the people who are really responsible for what happens in this country, and say they all were assembled on the lawn of the White House, maybe for the inauguration or some other event, some special event, and that what happened on 9/11 happened that day and was successful. Maybe multiple planes would fly into this group. And all of a sudden, the entire important people for the structure of our nation and defending our nation disappeared. You can imagine what that would do. Well, this was the same thing that happened to the Philistines. It all happened because of this one act that Samson did and completed when he died. Moving on to another example, another event. Starting in Esther 2, verse 8. Esther 2, verse 8. And this is the example of Queen Vashti had confronted King Ahasuerus. And I'm just going to refer to him as the king because it's hard to get that name out. She had rebelled against something that he had told her to do, against her commandment. And so he decided to replace her. And he sent out a decree, a commandment. And this decree was heard when many maidens were gathered together unto Shushan, the palace, to the custody of Hegel, that Esther was brought into the king's house to the custody of Hegel, keeper of the women. So this is where Esther enters this picture. She was one of the ones that was brought. And I don't know, it doesn't tell exactly what the selection process was. Just that, and the maiden, Esther, pleased him, and she obtained kindness of him, and he speedily gave her her things for purification and such things as belonged to her, and 7 maidens. So she had 7 maidens to take care of her, to prepare her. Maybe one was strictly involved in her manicures, one involved in her pedicures, one, you know, took care of her hair, someone else took care of her skin, her diet, her exercise, her posture, and her dress. I don't know what their responsibilities were, but I think a lot of you women wouldn't mind having 7 people working on you doing all of these things on a regular basis. Anyway, she was taught how to carry herself as a queen. And it says they were given to her out of the king's house, and he preferred her and her maids unto the best place of the house of the women. And it said Esther hadn't showed her people nor her kindred, for Mordecai, her adopted father, had charged her that she should not show it. So she was a Jew, but she was told and instructed by him not to say anything about that. And she didn't. Of course, there was a conspiracy afoot at that time. And Haman, one of the king's right-hand men, so to speak, had talked the king into signing a decree because he said the Jews are a threat and they need to be destroyed. And so the king signed a decree, thinking Haman was giving him the right advice that on such and such a day, that's going to happen. Verse 17. And the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And then this decree became known to Esther and to Mordecai. And picking this up in Esther 4, verse 11, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come into the king, into the inner court, who's not called, there is one law of his to be put to death. And this is where Mordecai had asked her, you've got to talk to the king about this. Otherwise, our race is threatened. Your life is threatened. But she said, you know, the only time that can happen, going on in the verse, except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter, that he may live. But I have not been called to come in unto the king these 30 days. So the last 30 days, Esther hadn't seen the king. And she said, it would be a real effrontery to him if I were to go in and demand to see him. Verse 16. So she said, I'll do it, but you have to do this. Go gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan and fast, you for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days and nights, and I also and my maidens will fast likewise. And so I will go in unto the king then, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish. So she was resigned to facing death if for some reason the king didn't hold out the golden scepter to her. Well, you know the story. She didn't perish, and the king let her speak. So she told him of Haman's conspiracy to destroy the Jews. And since the king couldn't rescind that original decree, he made a new one, giving the Jews the license and the opportunity to defend themselves, which is what they did. Esther 9, verse 5. Esther 9, verse 5. Thus the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, and slaughter and destruction, and did what they would unto those that hated them. So the Jews were able to take care of themselves. They were able to defend themselves. And so Esther was responsible for helping to save her family, her race. Turn to Daniel 6, verse 18. Another well-known story, Daniel 6, verse 18. And this here, again, talked about a conspiracy against Daniel. The nobles and everyone else that were competitors with him, so they thought, talked King Darius into signing a decree that no one should be able to petition anyone for the next 30 days except the king. And so they caught him, and the king had no recourse except to throw him into a line of den of lions. Then the king went to his palace and passed the night fasting. Neither were instruments of music brought before him, and his sleep went from him. Then he rose early in the morning and went in haste unto the den of lions. When he came to the den, he cried with a lamentable voice unto Daniel. And the king spake and said to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God, whom thou servest continually, able to deliver thee from the lions? So he had a question mark, and Daniel said unto him, O king, live forever. God has sent his angel and hath shut the lions' mouths, that they have not hurt me, for as much as I before him have was found innocent, and also before thee, O king, have I done no hurt. So all of the stories you heard about me were not true. What I did, but it wasn't a conspiracy against you. And Daniel 6, verse 25 is the end result of that. Then King Darius wrote unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and steadfast forever in his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end. So here, because of what had happened, the king had recognized that God had great power and that he should be respected and he should be worshiped. And so all of the things that happened to Daniel brought him to this point. Let's jump to the New Testament for a minute. John 9, verse 1. And as Jesus passed by, he saw a man which was blind from his birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Master, who did sin, the man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, neither hath he sinned, nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him. And so they thought, well, because he's blind, there must have been something somewhere in his lineage. Someone did something that caused this, but that wasn't the case. A lot of times you look around at things that happen to people and you wonder, why did that happen? What did they do? Now, sometimes they are responsible, but in this case, they weren't. And yet, because of this, this miracle, this was a way that God had of demonstrating that. One further story in Acts 27, verse 9. Now when much time was spent, and when sailing was now dangerous, because the fast was now already past, talking about the Day of Atonement, Paul admonished them. He was getting ready to get on this ship, and this was in the fall, because it was after the Day of Atonement. He said unto them, Sirs, I perceive that this voyage will be with hurt and much damage, not only of the lading, the cargo and ship, but also of our lives. And they didn't listen to him. They sailed anyway, and they ran aground off the island of Melita. In Acts 28, verse 3, and they, after being shipwrecked, were able to swim ashore, so there wasn't any loss of life. And when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, there came out a viper, had been hiding in this bundle, a very deadly snake, out of the heat and fastened on his arm, his hand. Verse 4, and when the barbarians saw the venomous beast hang onto his hand, they said among themselves, no doubt this man is a murderer. And he actually was when he was Saul. He'd consented to having Christians put to death, but not in this case. This man is a murderer whom, though he hath escaped the sea, yet vengeance suffereth not to live. So even though he survived the shipwreck, now he's getting his payback because of the snakes. And Paul shook off the beast into the fire and felt no harm. Howbeit they looked when he should have swollen or fallen down dead suddenly, but after they had looked a great while and saw no harm come to him, they changed their minds and said that he was a god. They thought he must possess superhuman qualities. In the same quarters were possessions of the chief man of the island, whose name was Publius, who received us and lodged us 3 days courteously. And it came to pass that the father of Publius lay sick of a fever and of a bloody flux, whom Paul entered in and laid his hands on him and healed him. So when this was done, others also, which had diseases in the island, came and were healed. So as a result of all of these things that had happened to Paul because of this ship, the sailing of the ship, the sinking of the ship, and then the example of the viper and being able to heal these people, he was able to help spread the gospel throughout that area. So we've looked at six different stories, you know, six examples of well-known accounts. Many of you have read numerous times, not only to yourselves, maybe to your children. When you think of all these examples, first Joseph, then Samson, then Esther, then Daniel, Jesus and the blind man, and finally Paul, we see six different examples of how God worked in rather strange and mysterious ways to achieve his purpose in their lives. No two of them were the same. You know, we've seen what happened to them individually, and in some cases how their families and countries were affected as well. They're all very different, and as I said, no two stories are the same. But they're all unique in and of themselves and illustrate the different methods God used to get his job done, whatever it was at that point in time. You know, most of us will get sick at one time or the other. Sometimes we know what has precipitated it, or understand that our negligence perhaps may have been a contributing factor. Maybe we have not been getting enough sleep or eating too many pieces of pie or cake for dessert. You know, our habits may have contributed to what happened to us, our illness. But sometimes we don't really know the cause. We don't know what caused it. Occasionally we get injured, and once again, maybe we were the cause because we took a risk we shouldn't have taken. But again, maybe we had nothing to do with it and were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. We may lose our job because of a mistake we made, or lose it because of something we had no control over whatsoever, such as a merger or a strike or a plant closing and moving to another state. Sometimes these things come about because of our own mistake, because of our own sins, but sometimes they occur for no apparent reason. That is, at least on the surface, how it may appear. Maybe it isn't apparent to us, but it's always quite clear to God. Maybe it isn't apparent to us, but it's always quite clear to God. Isaiah 55, verse 8. Isaiah 55, verse 8. I'm reading this from the New International Version, the NIV. My thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. So we don't begin to understand the way God thinks about different things. Because he said, our thoughts are different. Someday we will. Someday we'll look back. Someday we'll sit down with him and say, well, why did you do that in that way? You know, why did you decide to do this? And you can pick out any example in the Bible and say, that was a rather interesting way to get this result. Now, I think it's highly unlikely that you'll have to go through anything like the examples that we've looked at today, but I think it's safe to say that we will all have our own set of challenges and obstacles as we walk along the road we've chosen to follow. It may be helpful to look at our distress as it occurs and compare it to some of the examples we've reviewed today. You know, when we're in the midst of a trial, we might feel we'd gladly trade what's going on in our life for some of the people's examples we've reviewed this afternoon in exchange for our current misery. That is how trials affect us. But the reality is, it's far easier to endure whatever we may be enduring rather than try to exchange it for something that in the end may be far worse. You know, our father may be thinking, yes, this is what my son, and I'm going to use the masculine here, but I'm including women as well, simply so I don't have to repeat to refer to both. My son needs to learn at this time in his life. You know, we've been looking at him and we notice that he lacks patience. So let's help him develop more. How do we do this? Let's give him this specific obstacle and see how he handles it. You know, if you've ever served in the military, in your first 90 days of basic training, you learn these basic principles that are designed to do things like that for whoever goes through it, to bring structure into our lives where perhaps it wasn't or hasn't existed before, to help us learn discipline and obedience, because that training may well save our lives someday. In our cases, not only our physical lives, but more importantly, our spiritual lives as well. When we don't have the luxury of the time to think something through, but just snap to attention, say, yes, sir, or yes, ma'am, I'll do it. Even though God's ways are not our ways, it's important to always remember that all things, continue to say it, emphasize the all do work together for good. That principle was evident in all of the examples we read. Different things happening, but the end result, everything worked together for good. You know, as I said, at times we can't understand why we're undergoing a particular trial. And it may be years until we see the end result. And we should be in a better place, both physically and spiritually, even though we can't see it right now, or couldn't see it at first. If we place our trust in God and His ways, we can know with absolute certainty that we will always end up in the place He knows is best for us, the most ideal location for our physical as well as our spiritual growth, and which ultimately will be beneficial to us and our welfare, not only here and now today, but tomorrow, next week, next month, next year, and ultimately for all eternity.